Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Kevin Freeman, our senior fellow for economic warfare-related matters, a subject in which he is quite expert. Indeed, he is the author of globaleconomicwarfare.com, an invaluable website addressing these sorts of issues. Also, the author of Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And of particular, in very urgent relevance, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
I wanted to ask you, because you've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing on the threat of electromagnetic pulse, Kevin, and of course, as we've been discussing in the previous segments, North Korea has over the weekend declared that it is prepared to engage in an EMP attack against this country, perhaps using what seems to be an H-bomb, a thermonuclear weapon. Kevin, give us, if you would, your current assessment of our vulnerabilities to such an attack and the imperative of preventing it.
Well, thanks, Frank. Yes, you've been talking about the risk of EMP, and you've been talking about the risk of North Korea for a while. I covered it in my book, and yet it was dismissed repeatedly. The North Koreans, they're not advanced enough, they're not threatening enough. All of those seem to have been handily dismissed by reality over the weekend when they exploded what appears to be a hydrogen bomb. And in doing so, the Chinese are upset because this rankles global markets. It shows them to be less effective in any ability to rein in North Korea. It shows that they're willing to go against their Chinese masters, as they've been called. And then the immediate threat, very publicly, we'll use for an EMP if we want to. They just dismissed all of the naysayers, and it's just proven what you've said for at least a dozen years that I've known to be accurate.
I just as soon have been wrong about this, to be honest with you, and I'm appreciative of you calling to mind the history here, but it is one of these things that we should have addressed a long time ago, and we can't afford to tarry about any longer. A point that I believe, Kevin, was underscored by the effects of Hurricane Harvey in your native state of Texas. I wanted you to talk a little bit about some of the insights that we've had when the power has gone out in Houston and some of the surrounding communities as a result of that terrible storm, and what it really should teach us about the imperative of making the grid more resilient without further delay.
This is another lesson from Mother Nature, so to speak, that how vulnerable our power grid is and how vulnerable modern society is to a lack of power. I mean, you could go back to the tsunami that hit Japan and the Fukushima nuclear problems they had. Wasn't because the water, it was because they ran out of power. And we've seen the similar things in Houston with chemical plants that require power for cooling of chemicals, and if you can't cool them, they explode. I saw here in Dallas-Fort Worth area, the impact is that we had gas stations that were silent, not because of a lack of power, but because of a lack of gasoline. But the effect is the same. Without power, you can't pump gasoline out of gas stations, which means you don't have transportation, which means you have food shortages. You know, it just leads, one thing leads to another to another. That is the underlying critical infrastructure.
It is indeed. And Kevin Freeman, one other lesson of Harvey was with respect to the oil infrastructure of this country, the energy infrastructure more generally as well. Of course, you mentioned disruption of supply in your own hometown. There have been price spikes, if not actual unavailability of gasoline elsewhere around the country. I'm also reminded of something else that we've been discussing and worrying about, and that is, if Mother Nature could take offline refineries with ripple effects through our economy, what about having hostile powers, or potentially hostile powers at the very least, like Saudi Arabia and Russia owning some of those refineries and choosing, should they decide to do so, to take them offline? Would that cause similar kinds of dislocation and disruption? And should we allow them to own such facilities?
Well, absolutely, it would cause that. They could. They would have the ability to take refineries offline if they chose. And we might have to go in and nationalize the refineries, which would take away some of America's claim to morality in the world. You know, we don't nationalize industries. But they could do that, or terrorists could sneak in and blow them up. I mean, we are very, very vulnerable to the energy infrastructure of the country. So there's no doubt. And having Saudi Arabia or the Russians controlling a huge chunk of our refining capacity, as is the case from what's happened in Venezuela and elsewhere, it puts us at serious risk. We become vulnerable to the whims of foreign dictators.
Kevin, I want to switch gears with you. We've been talking with several of our guests in this program about threats to freedom of speech. You had a terrific post on that subject at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Would you talk about it as a domestic problem in this country at the moment?
Well, I started digging into this with the SPLC designation of hate groups and so forth.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, one of my least favorite organizations, yes.
With good reason, right? And George Soros and Media Matters, someone else who's blatantly attacked you, according to WikiLeaks. And I'd started to dig into it because I'm very concerned that any contrary speech is considered hate speech and therefore forbidden. And I remember being in entering college in 1978 when the ACLU was demanding that the Nazis have the right to march in Skokie, Illinois. And I thought, what has happened on our campuses? What's happened particularly with the internet? We're seeing the systematic removal of free speech protections across media, entertainment, newspapers and reporting, internet. And this is a real threat to the American way of life, because these things can be funded by external sources. We saw the Southern Poverty Law Group have millions and millions of dollars offshore. We've seen that. That's been reported. Well, how do we know that they're not taking foreign contributions? How do we know that the Russians aren't using that as a means to influence? If you could target a hate group that goes against Russian policy, you could influence American politics.
Well, the Russians or for that matter, various countries espousing Islamism and seeking to shut down any discussion of what they're up to, the Muslim Brotherhood among them. I mean, these are very real concerns, Kevin, and you've gone through and you've talked about a number of ways in which this is manifesting itself. But I did want you to just take a moment to talk about the practice of shaming and how it fits into these sort of techniques for the purposes of silencing political opposition.
Well, I first heard this from Steve Coughlin, our mutual friend, who pointed out that the former Secretary of State Clinton, at a speech, I think it was at the United Nations, said, well, we have this pesky thing called the First Amendment, but we have the ability to shame people into activity and to stop activity we don't like by shaming it. And then I've watched it play out. He shared it with me. This is a horrifying ability to make someone feel stupid because they take a position that they've long held. So a Christian has long held that marriage is between one man and one woman, and well, you should be ashamed of yourself. You're Islam or you're a homophobe. Or if you happen to believe that women should be free to wear whatever they want to and in public and should be able to have all the benefits afforded by the Constitution and family law and so forth, well, then you're an Islamophobe. Or if you say that all lives matter, you're automatically a racist. And these are shaming techniques used to achieve specific political goals.
And specifically, those goals are to silence us. And what worries me particularly, Kevin Freeman, is we've been subjected to this, as you said, for essentially pointing out what is being done covertly, stealthily in this country, notably by the Sharia supremacists doing business as the Muslim Brotherhood, is to essentially enable them to get away with their covert, or as they call it, civilization jihad. It's a very, very important form of political warfare, and we appreciate you diagnosing it so powerfully at globaleconomicwarfare.com. I hope you'll come back to us with more insights on all of this next week. In the meantime, Kevin Freeman, thank you very much for your leadership in so many areas. Keep it up. We'll talk next with Michelle Garfinkel about some of those efforts to shame us into silence, as evidenced in his native France, and more generally in Europe, and what it might mean for us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.